All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Glad you could join us on this Sunday morning. And again, as Pastor Sam mentioned earlier, lots of things happening today where we have our Sunday Q&A after worship and also members meetings tonight. We also this week have our Bible study, and we hope we could see you there on Wednesday. And even a lot of things happening this month. And our members meeting is going to explain what's going to be happening with our church in the month of March and April. A lot of things will be happening. And so hope if you're a member, you could join us there. If you're new or visiting our church, we welcome you to our Sunday worship. And my name is Pastor Thomas. I'm one of the pastors here. And the past few weeks, we've actually been going through a sermon series in the book of Genesis from chapters 12 to 32. And for the past few chapters, we've been looking at the life of Abraham. And we've been kind of journeying with Abraham and seeing how God interacts with him and where God's leading him. And the past few weeks, though, we slowed down in chapters 18 and 19. And we're looking at one 24-hour day of Abraham's life for the past few weeks. 2 weeks ago, if you guys remember, the way this day started out was in the morning, God and two angels, they came and they visited Abraham and they ate with him and they spoke with Sarah. Last week, we saw that in the afternoon, after they finished eating lunch, the two angels left, and now it's just the Lord and Abraham, and they had a deep conversation with one another, and they kind of leveled up in their relationship together. Today, what we're going to be looking at is we're going to see those two angels who came with God but then left. We're going to see where those angels went. And those angels, they actually went on a trip to visit the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it's a very interesting trip that happened when they went to those cities. Today is Genesis chapter 19. And this chapter, if you're not familiar with it, it is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is one of the most significant and controversial passages, not only in Genesis, but of the entire Bible. And the reason why is because the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, it is always referred back to throughout the Old Testament. All the prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, they always refer back to, remember Sodom and Gomorrah? And even in the New Testament, Jesus, he always refers back to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it's so interesting because even though the Bible constantly references the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, the modern church rarely preaches on it. Go on any church website and you see their series on Genesis, because I've done that just to see what other churches did. Every single one, they preach on every chapter besides chapter 19. It's something that the church just kind of avoids. And I don't blame them. I completely understand. And when we read it together, you'll see probably why. Because this story, it depicts God in a very uncomfortable way for modern ears. And this story is often used as rhetoric against certain types of sins. And for some of us, that's probably how we've heard it, is we just see this passage as, oh, I know about that story. It's used as rhetoric and it's something about sin being bad. But I think when you actually look closely at the story, you're going to see why the Bible keeps referring back to it and why it's so significant. And so that's my hope today. And even though it's a little bit longer passage, you guys could turn to your Bibles to Genesis 19, and we're going to read it together. We're going to read from chapter 19 from verse 1 to 16, and then we're going to skip over to verse 23 to 29. So Genesis chapter 19. Starting in verse 1, and we go all the way to verse 16. And again, we're going to skip a few verses and go to verse 23 to 29. So if you're there with me, I'll read starting in verse 1, and if you could follow along. Chapter 19, verse 1, it says, "The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, 'My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way.' They said, 'No, we will spend the night in the town square.' But he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, 'Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them.' Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, 'I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof.' But they said, 'Stand back.' And they said, 'This fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them.' And then they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break down the door. But the men who reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door.
And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out groping for the door. Then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy this place, because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his son-in-laws to be jesting. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, and the Lord being merciful to him, they brought him out and set him outside the city. And we can skip down to verse 23. It says, and the sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. The Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived. This is the reading of God's word. And all God's people said, yikes, that is quite the passage, quite the epic story. In fact, one thing I think about when I read the story is that it kind of feels almost like those classic disaster movies. I don't know if you guys ever watched those movies like Armageddon or Twister or Dante's Peak. If you watched those movies before, they're especially classic in the 90s. What happens is those are disaster movies, and all those movies, they always began the opening scene with a smaller version of the disaster that's coming. You notice like Armageddon, for example, it begins where there's a small asteroid that comes and it does damage to the city. Or in Twister, there's a small tornado that destroys a house. Or Dante's Peak, a small tremor of an earthquake. And the reason why every movie begins that way is because those smaller disasters, they're meant to be a precursor for the big one that's coming. There's a big one that's coming, a big asteroid, a bigger tornado, a bigger earthquake. And the rest of the movie is about preparing for that big one that's coming. Now, that's kind of what's happening here in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. As we read this story, you might think, cool story. Okay, what does that have to do with me? Something about an ancient city getting destroyed. That's interesting. But realize the reason why this story is here, even though it has nothing really to do with the Abrahamic covenant, and the reason why the Bible always refers back to it is because this story is meant to be a precursor for readers to prepare for something bigger that's coming, God's judgment. Genesis 19 is meant to be a passage where it's supposed to wake up people from their everyday lives and to see that something big happened and something bigger is gonna happen. And I know as I talk about this, about how something big is happening, God's judgment, right now I sound like a fire and brimstone Puritan preacher. I feel it seems like this is a message meant for people in the 16th century wearing white wigs and getting ready to burn witches. Like, this is the kind of tone that is almost set here. But I'd actually beg to argue that perhaps this message is something that modern people need to hear a lot more often, not so that we could get freaked out and be fearful people, but so that we could have better perspective. Imagine if the movie we saw, a disaster movie, if all the characters heard an asteroid was coming, but then they were stressed about their grades still. Like, oh, what about my grades? Oh, what about my money? Oh, what about my house? And are we gonna be able to upgrade our home? You would look at that thinking, how silly, how trivial in light of what's gonna happen in this story. And in a similar way, I can't help but think for a lot of us, we are grumbling and we tend to grumble over the most trivial things. Real problems, but quite trivial compared to the big picture of what's happening in life. And so what this passage is meant to do is to wake us up from the triviality of what we tend to grumble about, to see a big picture of what's happening in life. And so while this passage may not be the most uplifting passage, it may not be the most encouraging passage, I do think this is meant to be a passage that wakes up God's people. And again, to make us see, hey, what's God really planning and what's he's really doing in this world? And so today, again, we are going to be talking about a subject that the modern church often avoids. But here at our church, we don't. We believe in preaching the whole counsel of God. The modern church avoids this, but yet we need it so much. And it's the idea of God's coming judgment. And we're going to talk about God's judgment in three ways. First, the reality of judgment. Second, the rescue from judgment. And then last, the response to judgment. So the reality, the rescue, the response. Three R's. Let's look at the first point. The reality of judgment. Genesis 19, this passage begins where two angels, they enter the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they meet Lot, who's sitting at the gate. Now, again, if you forgot who Lot was, but Lot, he was, you know, he's been there. He was Abraham's nephew. And when the angels meet him, Lot, he welcomes these angels. He bows to them. He tells them, come to my home, and he prepares a meal for them. If that sounds familiar to you, that means you were paying attention 2 weeks ago in chapter 18 when Abraham met these angels and he did almost the exact same thing. In fact, if you compare chapter 18 in verses 1 to 4 to chapter 19 verses 1 to 3, you will see almost the exact language used with Abraham and Lot, the way they are both hospitable to these angels. Except one difference. While Abraham offers them to come over and the angels accept Abraham's offer, in chapter 19 with Lot, the angels initially refuse. They don't want to come over to Lot's house. Why? The reason why is because while the angels came to Abraham to eat with him and talk to him, they did not come to Sodom to eat and talk with Lot. In chapters 18, last week, verses 20, 21, we know why the angels are here. They came because God heard an outcry in the city. And so the angels, they are coming like two detectives to investigate the city and see, is everything happening the way it's supposed to happen, like that we heard? Is there an outcry? Is there a wickedness happening? Is there injustice? Are there any righteous here that we have to save? That's what the angels are doing. But Lot keeps pressing. He keeps talking, saying, come over, please. And so the angels come and they go to Lot's house and they eat. But then we see shortly while they're eating exactly what kind of city this is. Look again what it says in verses 4 to 5. But before they lay down, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, they surrounded the house and they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. Now notice the emphasis on everybody came, the whole city, meaning that the author's trying to make clear this entire city is pretty wicked. They're all surrounding the house and there's something really wrong with the city of Sodom. Now, what is so wrong with this city? What is it about this city that's so wicked that God plans to bring judgment here? If you grew up in a very traditional conservative church, like maybe I have, then you would hear that this, you know what the problem was with the city of Sodom and Gomorrah? There is a single sin issue going on here. They are practicing homosexuals, and oftentimes the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is this story that is a rhetoric used against, and if you're a practicing homosexual, God's going to judge you, and fire and brimstone, and that's what we hear, right? The solid story of Sodom and Gomorrah for traditional conservative Christians who grew up in the church, it is a story about God's judgment against homosexuality. And there's reasons for that, because they say, look, these men, they wanted to know these angels. The word know is euphemism for sexual relations in the book of Genesis. They wanted to rape these men and get to know them, and God was intolerant of that, and this is a story judging this. So therefore, we must, you know, homosexuality is wrong. Now, here's a problem with that view. The problem with that view is that, in one hand, there is sexual sin going on in the story, but you know, whenever the rest of the Bible talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, and I mentioned before, the Bible always talks about it, it talks about way more issues than that. For example, in Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49, Sodom and Gomorrah is brought up, and Ezekiel goes, you know why Sodom was judged? It was judged for social injustice, their lying, and their greed. Interesting. Or Jeremiah 23, he says, you know why Sodom and Gomorrah was judged? Adulterers. They were adulterers. They weren't faithful in their marriages. Or Isaiah chapter 1, when it talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, he goes, you know why they were judged? Social oppression. They were committing social injustice in the land. And so, what made Sodom and Gomorrah a wicked city, a corrupt city, I would argue it is not a single sin issue. But the problem was they practiced all types of sins. It was an overall wicked city. And therefore, what I would say is that you shouldn't use this story as a rhetoric of how God's going to judge one particular sin and how he hates one particular sin. The story is much, much worse than that. God judges all particular sins. He judges all kinds of sins. He does not let one sin go unjudged. Because the reason why the God of the Bible, he doesn't just hear the outcry of the sexual morals. He hears the outcry of social injustice, of greed, of lying, of all types of sins, because all sins are injustice in God's eyes. And as we talked about last week, God does not let the outcry of injustice go unpunished. He is a God who is the judge of all the earth, and he will bring justice, and we see it through his judgment. And that's exactly what happens in Genesis 19. The story kind of, we see what happens in verses 24 to 25, where if you look there, it says, "And then the Lord, he rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the city." God just completely destroyed the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And this isn't a one-time thing. As I mentioned, the Bible always refers to this, and this is a precursor to a greater judgment. In Luke chapter 17, Jesus says, "Just as it was in the day when Lot went out for Sodom and fire and sulfur rained and destroyed them, so it will be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed." 2 Peter chapter 2 says the same thing. "Just as Sodom and Gomorrah was burned to ashes, this is an example of what's going to happen to the ungodly." The Bible says this is something that's a precursor. Bigger things coming where all the earth is going to be judged, not just the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, last week, I talked about how, and this has to happen because God, he is going to tackle justice, and therefore he must judge. And yet when you hear this, or if you read the story and you're really paying attention, it's still uncomfortable, right? It's still a passage that, I'm not sure if I'd preach this at a wedding, or I'm not sure if I would do a Bible study with somebody who's new to the faith about this, because this is not a comfortable thing. And a lot of modern Christians, we don't talk about this passage, we skip it, or we reject it altogether. Why? Last week, we talked about the fact that why God had to judge, but why are we so uncomfortable with God judging? And let me propose two reasons why it's so hard for us today. One reason why God's judgment makes modern people so uncomfortable is because we live overly comfortable lives. It's uncomfortable because we are comfortable. There's a theologian, Croatian theologian named Miroslav Volf. And Miroslav Volf, and he's, again, lived in Croatia. He went into a school to learn theology, and he kind of grew up in his studies thinking, I don't really like the idea that God judges, that the God of the Bible judges. And his question was, how can God be love, but judge people and send people to hell? Those seem like counter truths. I can't reconcile those. And so his mantra was, if God is wrathful, if he is a wrathful God, he is not worthy of my worship. And so Miroslav Volf just denied that God was a judging God until something happened. Something happened in his life that changed everything. He was from Croatia. And if you're familiar with history in the 90s, something happened in the 90s where war entered into the land of Croatia. And when that happened, when war entered into his land, it literally changed his worldview because he saw so much violence, he saw so much wickedness, and he saw so many dead people from victims that he grew so angry at all the injustice happening that his new mantra was, if God is not angry about this, if he is not wrathful about this, that God is not worthy of my worship. And he says that anyone who has a problem now, he realizes, about God's judgment, you are far too cozy. You're living far too cozy of a life. That's what's going on. He says, quote, "Our coziness with the surrounding culture have made us so blind to many of its evils. To the person who is inclined to dismiss divine judgment, I suggest imagining you're delivering that lecture in a war zone. Soon you would discover that it takes the quiet of a suburban home for the birth of that thesis. In a scorched land soaked in the blood of the innocent, it will invariably die." In other words, the only people who have a hard time with God judging things is if people have nothing to judge. We're good. How could God do this? But realize that is such a Western privileged life that has a problem because we don't really experience that much injustice. So that's our first problem. We are uncomfortable with God's judgment because we're comfortable. But here's the second problem why I think a lot of us tend to be uncomfortable. The reason why God's judgment makes us modern people uncomfortable is that if he judges all injustice, then that means we're going to get judged. Because if we're honest with ourselves, we've committed injustices. We've wronged people. And this means if God brings all that into account one day, we are going to be brought into account. Rebecca Pipper in her book, Stay Salt, says it like this. Our problem is that we want God to right all the wrong, just so long as his divine justice isn't aimed at us. But we can't have it both ways. A just God who will one day right all the evils of injustice cannot be expected to suddenly behave like a benign celestial Santa Claus when it comes to us. And she says, lastly, the seeds of injustice, they are ultimately the result of our human rebellion against God, and those seeds have taken roots in our own hearts too. In other words, we have done bad things, and deep down inside, we know, we might get punished for that. You know how many people I've counseled in our church where something bad happens? And they go, I go, what do you think is going on? And they go, I can't help but think God's punishing me. I'm like, for what? And they're like, well, let me tell you what I did. And they'll confess these secret dark things to me. I'm like, oh, wow, like, you've done some things that you feel really guilty about and you don't know what to do with it. And you're kind of thinking this suffering is it's deserving. And that's how people are because we've done bad things. And if God said he's going to bring justice to all that, we are susceptible to that justice. Now, as I say all this, I know for some of us, we go, okay, amen, I believe that. But some of us, we don't agree with that or we don't believe that to be true. Or we go, I don't want to presume that all of us do believe this. But just realize this path so far, what it does is it challenges us about our life. This challenges us about how we view death and even how we view justice. For some of us, if you didn't grow up in the church or you don't think Christianity is true, when you die, what we often have is a naturalistic view where our brains are just going to shut down. We're just going to pass away and we're going to turn to dust and that's it. And that's fine. That makes sense. But realize that that's true. If we just die and there's nothing else, there is no cosmic justice. Every injustice that happens in the world is just left out there. And that's a tension you have to live with. It's a tension. What do we do with injustice then? Well, let's pretend for some of you, you're less morbid than that. You have a Disney view of life. You go, hey, when I die, it's like the movie Soul. I'm going to go up the stairway and I don't know where I'm going, but I'm going somewhere that's probably different and better than here. We all go to this escalator towards heaven. That's fine, but there's tension. There's tension of what do you do about injustice? That means that injustice happens and there is no cosmic judgment that takes place. That's the tension you have to live with. If you're a Christian though, you have a different tension. There's still tension. After you die, what Christians believe is there is a God who judges. He doesn't just have an escalator to heaven. He's going to judge and every injustice will be accounted for. And what's nice about that is, okay, there is cosmic justice. Stalin, Hitler, they don't just get away with things. So there is justice, but there's still tension. What's going to happen to the injustice you've done? How do you live with that? And a lot of us, the way we deal with it is guilt, shame, secrets, keep things in the dark. And that kind of jacks us. You live with tension no matter what, but what do you do with that tension? And what does Christians say you do with that tension within us? That leads to the second point, the rescue from judgment. To answer that tension, we're going to take a deep dive into the one person who did not perish in Sodom, Abraham's nephew, Lot. Now, Lot, there's not much written about him. We first met him in Genesis 12, where he was Abraham's nephew, and he saw God call Abraham, and he went with Abraham. Genesis 13, if you remember, they had to separate because there's conflict, and Lot chose the land by sight, so he saw him go there. Then he got in trouble, and Genesis 14, Abraham had to rescue him, and we haven't seen Lot since then. And in the meantime, Abraham, he entered into a covenant with God, while Lot, apparently, when we find him now, he has moved to the city of Sodom, and he's been living in that city. And so in Genesis 19, we are now going to see what happened to Lot. And when you see Lot, he is one of the most fascinating, interesting characters in the Bible. He's so interesting. And the reason why he is so interesting, even though there's not much written about him, is because he is so complex. As Christians, you don't know what to do with him. He's not that bad, and yet he's not that good. He's like in this weird gray area. For example, notice in verse 1, when we first encounter Lot, notice Lot is sitting at the gate of Sodom when the angels come. Now, on the one hand, he's a good guy because when the angels come, he's so nice to them. He's the only person in the whole city to welcome them. And he's a lot like Abraham, where he's hospitable and he's just a really gracious host, which is good. But here's the bad thing. why is Lot sitting at the gate of Sodom? This city is so wicked, why is he there? And the reason why is because he's a part of that community, even though it's a wicked community. Imagine you come to our church and you see somebody at the welcoming table go, welcome to our church. You would presume that person is part of this church. He's not a newcomer, he's part of them. Lot, the same thing. He ain't just there because he's new. He is part of that community sitting at the gate. So good and bad there. Here's another thing that's interesting. Notice in verses 7-8, how Lot, when all the men surround his home and they want to sexually assault the angels, notice how Lot responds. On the one hand, it's pretty honorable. Lot does not participate in the sexual act. And Lot, he tells him, stop, this is wicked, don't do this. So you're like, wow, Lot, good for you. You're a brave guy. And then all of a sudden, the bad. He goes, and take my daughters. They're virgins. Do with them whatever you want. And you're like, whoa, Lot, you dropped the ball on that one. Like, you are doing so good. And all of a sudden, what is this weird thing of you offering your daughters there? And lastly, notice in verses 12 to 16, the angels, they tell Lot to, hey, God's judgment is coming. The city's going to get destroyed. Get your family and get out. And so in verse 14, Lot goes to his son-in-laws and he says, get out. The Lord's going to destroy the city. Flee. But then in verse 15, even though Lot believes they get out, in verse 15, the angels come to him and going, the time has come. Leave the city. Take your family. And what does it say in verse 16? But Lot lingered. He stayed in the city. He was just like, whatever. What do you do with this guy? Who is Lot? How do we make sense of him? And I'm very aware of 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7. And we could talk about that in a Sunday Q&A. But what do you do with Lot in Genesis 19? How do we make sense of this character? I like what one author says, how he summarizes who Lot is. You know who Lot is? Quote, Lot is a nice, moral man, but he does not have God spiritually working in his life to grow him. Lot has not made a covenant with God. He has not left everything to serve the living God as Abraham has. God is just one of many concerns in Lot's life. So his character is a patchwork of light and darkness. In other words, Lot is a great example of a well-meaning, good and decent person who has a conscience and has tried to be religious in a general way, but his human resources and his human wisdom has only brought him out into a place of peril. In other words, Lot is a good guy. He thinks he's a decent guy, and that's why he is the way he is. And that explains why, even though judgment is coming, and the angel said, judgment is coming, Lot's like to his son-in-laws, get out, God's judgment is coming, but he's just chilling. Why? Lot think he's okay. You guys aren't good, but I'm good. I'm a decent guy. I'm not like the people of Sodom. I know the God of Abraham. I'm good. And here's the problem. Lot was about to die. He was about to get consumed in the judgment just like everybody else. He was just as susceptible. He should have died. But the only reason he was not consumed wasn't because Lot tried really hard to escape. Wasn't because Lot was a righteous person, but because of God's mercy. Look what it says in verse 16. Lot lingered. And so the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him and set him outside the city. It was only because of God's mercy that Lot was rescued. Now, does Lot remind you of somebody? Does Lot feel familiar to someone that you know? He should. And let me tell you who Lot should remind you of. He should remind you of you. We are Lot. We are way more like Lot than we are like Abraham. You see, while Abraham, he left everything to serve God, to make God his status, to make God his wealth, to make God his inheritance, Lot, for God was just one concern for Lot. He was one of many concerns in his life. Oh yeah, there's God, but there's also my job. There's also my family. There's also money. God was just one of many things. Like Lot, we who believe compared to Sodom, he's fine. He's better than those guys. We think we're fine too. We think of the worst person we know, go, I think I'm better than that guy, so I'm not doing too bad. Like Lot, who warns other people about God's judgment, but he himself feels fine. We are people where we're going to go on missions and we need to share the gospel and believe in Jesus and share about our faith. But in our own personal life, we don't really see much of that reflecting. In other words, like Lot, we think we are nice, moral people who know God. And therefore, we're pretty okay. And so when you hear a message like judgment, you think, oh, I wish my friend was here to hear this. Somebody needs to hear this message. Oh, I know somebody who should have been this Sunday. They got to hear this stuff. Whereas in reality, God is using the story to talk about you because you're Lot. And you think and you know enough about God and you do enough good things to be apathetic. You know enough theology to be apathetic about God. And this is why for some of us, we need to repent about the bad things we do. But for religious people, especially who think they're decent moral people, you need to repent of not just the bad things, but the good things you do. Because far too often we trust in our church history, our decent morality, our spiritual disciplines to justify us and think we're being good people. And that's why the gospel isn't good news to us, because there's no bad news for you. You're good. And so when you hear the gospel, you go, that's cool. That's good news. I guess that's pretty good. You're just chill. And you're on cruise control spiritually because you think you're good. And this is where the gospel enters into our life and is meant to humble us. Where it's nothing that you do that grants you mercy or that saves you. It's only God's mercy that can save and offer you the grace you need. I remember when I was dating my wife before we got married, I thought that we were so good in our dating relationship that we were set up for a great, healthy marriage. And the reason why is because we did everything right. My wife and I, we did not sleep together before we got married. We barely touched each other before we got married. We always tried to pray together before we got married. We read Christian books about marriage. We did everything right. And because we did everything right, I was really confident going to marriage. I was like, I got this marriage thing. I read everything. I prayed about it. We didn't do the touchy-touchy stuff. And so we're good. And so whenever people ask, what do you need prayer for? I didn't really ask prayer for my marriage because I'm good. Whenever people have marriage seminars, I'm like, oh, I'm good. I don't need to waste my time there because we're good. First 2 years of marriage, got rocked, humbled. All of a sudden, we are fighting. All of a sudden, we're not really connecting. We just had this big rift all the time, and we've had to see marriage counseling because it was so hard. And I remember when that happened, I learned, oh my gosh, what I really thought, so long as you read Christian books on marriage and you were both Christian, you're good. Your marriage is going to work. And that just got destroyed in those first years of marriage where I realized, oh my gosh, the only thing that's going to sustain a person's marriage is not what you learned. It's not what you do. It's literally the mercy of God and the grace he shows you each day. There's nothing about me or about my wife that's going to make this marriage work. It's literally the grace of God that's going to sustain us to make this marriage work. And because of that, now I am very humbled by marriage. I don't give marriage seminars, man. I am humbled by marriage. I always ask people, hey, can you pray for my marriage? Can you pray for it? I need prayer for my marriage now. I'm always curious to learn more. I want to learn more. Hey, you're growing in marriage. Tell me about it, because I really want to know, because I just don't know what to do. And in a similar way, when you realize it's nothing you do, but it's only God's mercy that saves you, it changes you. It humbles you. You see, you realize you need prayer. You need people to pray for you or you're done. You're going to be curious to learn, what does this grace mean? Like, what does it mean to grow in grace? You're going to realize there's nothing I do, but I need God to do something in order for me to still be sustained in this life. Grace changes you. The gospel humbles you. And the question is, are you humbled by the gospel, or are you like Lot, where everything's just chill? You're good. You don't need church. You don't need Bible studies. You don't need prayer. You're good. I've done all that. I'm good. Does your life look like a patchwork where there's goodness, there's God, and there's not God? It's just kind of all over the place because you forgot that it's only grace and grace alone and God's mercy that sustains you. Only if you know that can God rescue you from the judgment that awaits for us. And that leads to the last point, the response. In light of all this, in light of hearing about how judgment is there, how we need God's mercy to be rescued, how should we respond? And this story gives us three different responses. In light of God, the asteroid that's impending, how should we look at that? And there's three ways. First, you can respond like the Sodomites, the people of Sodom. Lot's son-in-laws, they were from the city of Sodom. They heard the news of judgment and they didn't really take it seriously. Verse 14, look what it said. Lot went and said to his son-in-laws who were to marry his daughters, get out of this place. The Lord's about to destroy the city. And what do?
they seem to his son-in-laws to be jesting. This is how a lot of us feel when we hear the story. Oh, judgment's there. Oh, death. Okay, whatever. That's funny. That's an interesting story. And the reason why is because, to be honest, our church is young. Death feels really far away. We're like in our 20s or 30s, so we feel pretty good. But let me tell you, you're going to get older one day. And the closer you are to death, and some of us are a little bit closer than others, things get a little more left. Things get a little bit less funny. When you have family members who pass away and death starts to arise in your life, that question isn't as funny as it used to be when we were in our 20s or 30s. There's a story of this man named Adoniram Judson. He was a missionary in the 1800s. And in his biography, you learn that Judson, he was actually a son to a preacher. So his family is Christians, but he went to college and he learned under a man named Jacob Eames. Jacob Eames was this brilliant person who pretty much taught Judson that, hey, this Christian stuff is pretty whack. And so what ended up happening is under influence, Judson, he renounced his faith under learning Jacob Eames. And so his parents were devastated, obviously, but then he was like, whatever. And later as Judson got older, he moved to New York City and he was going to become an actor. And in his first trip there, in his biography, it says he stayed in the Village Inn. And when he was in the Village Inn, all of a sudden he heard someone coughing next door. And it was just really loud and the walls were really thin. And he was wondering, like, man, this guy's cough sounds bad. It sounds like he's almost gonna die because it was just so bad. And the guy was moaning. And so that throughout the night. Next morning, Judson went to the innkeeper and he said, thanks for the stay. Hey, what? I heard a guy coughing. Like, is that guy okay next door? And the innkeeper said, oh, he died last night. And Judson's like, are you serious? Who was that guy? He was, oh, his name was Jacob Eames. And Judson's like, whoa, he had no idea his mentor was sitting in the exact same room as him. And he records in his biography how shocked he was, how he couldn't move. He just stayed in his room. And for the first time, rather than this abstract concept, he thought of the reality of death. He thought about, this is real. Something happens after you die. What's going to happen to me? And that led to his conversion, where he became a missionary. Now, I'm not saying the same thing's going to happen to you, where somebody dies, or if you experience death like that, that you're going to become a missionary and be converted. But one day, people you love will die. And one day, this will become less funny. And it becomes less trivial. And therefore, to think this is no big deal, get ready for a big existential crisis to come your way. Get ready for a lot of questions to come when those moments come. And so if this is a gesture thing, then just realize if you respond like the Sodomites, you are delaying the inevitable conversation that you need to have about what's going to happen when we die. So that's one way to respond. Here's a second way we respond, though. Not the Sodomites, but Lot's wife. Isn't this interesting, Lot's wife? Lot's wife was with Lot, and she followed Lot out of Sodom, and all of a sudden something weird happens. Look what it says in verse 26. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Really weird, right? I don't know about you, but when I imagine that, it's kind of comical. It's almost like the running fire is coming down, and she looks back, poof! Condiment, like she's just salt, like on the earth. And you're like, what in the world? Now, I don't think that's what happened, because notice it doesn't say God turned her into salt. What does it say? She became a pillar of salt, meaning that even her looking back, it's most likely like an action verb, meaning she didn't just glance. But what most commentator thinks, and I agree, is she turned back. She ran back. This Sodom was near the Dead Sea, so it's really salty. And so what happened was she went back to the city. Even though she knew judgment was going to come, she got destroyed with the city and she became a pillar of salt. I mean, that's what was going on. Now, what does this mean for us? This picture of Lot's wife is a reminder for us that we can't tell God, hey, okay, I'm gonna go to you, God, but when I'm ready. When I'm ready, just let me live life a little first, and then I'll go to you. And this is something that happens all the times in your 20s and 30s. I did the Christian thing when I was in college. I served in parachurch ministries. I try to be good. But now that I'm living my own, and I know I should now really grow in the faith, just give me time to live. Let me live a little. Let me live my 20s and 30s, and let me just enjoy. And then later, when I get a family and kids, I'll start going to church again. Then later, I'll do the Christian thing again. Just let me take a moment to live. But here's the thing. You don't know how you're going to turn out in your 20s and 30s when you live that way. You don't know if you're going to turn back to God. You don't know how spiritually hardened and indifferent you tend to become, where you end up becoming like Lot's wife, a pillar of salt, stone, hardened, and it's hard to turn back. In other words, you can't have it both ways. Let me enjoy the world and let me go back to you, God, at one point or another. That's not how things work.
That's not how life works. If you respond to the judgment of God by Lot's wife's way, that's often what's going to happen. And Lot's wife serves as an example. So don't look at Sodom. Don't look at Lot. Who should we be looking at? Who should we be looking at? It's not Lot. Lot sucks. Lot's not a good guy. Who do we look at? Notice how the story ends and tells us how we should look. The story ends the way the whole day began. Abraham comes back. And in verse 27 and 28, it says, Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord, and he looked towards Sodom and Gomorrah, towards the land of the valley, and he saw all the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. Why is Abraham just standing down in the evening looking at the city destroyed? Why is Abraham staring at Sodom and Gomorrah? Remember Genesis 18. Abraham had talked to God, interceding on their behalf, saying, Lord, would you spare the city if there are 10 righteous there? And God said, yes, I would. But now we see that there's nobody righteous in the city. The city was not spared, and it was destroyed. The only person who God spared was Lot, not because Lot was good, but in verse 29, it says, God remembered Abraham. In a similar way, the Bible says, you and I, we commit injustice all the time, and no one is righteous, not one, and we deserve judgment too. But the gospel tells us that we have a greater Abraham who intercedes on our behalf, but he doesn't say, Lord, would you spare them if they are righteous? If any of them are righteous, will you spare them? That's not what Jesus does. What the gospel tells us is Jesus intercedes on our behalf, asking, Lord, would you spare them if I'm righteous? Based on my righteousness, would you spare this people? And the result of that is that at the cross, the flames of Sodom and Gomorrah did not come down and consume us, but the flames came down on Christ on our behalf. And if we place our trust and faith in him, even if we're as silly and stupid and self-righteous as someone like Lot, God says he will rescue you. God says he will save you. God says judgment does not await you. And so for those of us here who perhaps we need to have a sober view of life, realize, and we're bickering about the smaller things, this passage is meant to be a wake-up call about, hey, there's something bigger happening in life. Are we aware of that? For those of us who are like Lot, we just are content and chill. This passage is meant to wake us up and be like, there's nothing you do, but something must be done to you in order for you to be okay. And for those of us who might be defeated or discouraged, this passage reminds us that God has not just come to judge, he has sent a savior, and his name is Christ. And he has taken the wrath of Sodom and Gomorrah on our behalf because of his great love for us and his people. So let's remember these truths. Let's not shy away from these truths, but especially as a church, let's really grow in understanding this is who our God is, and this is how he calls us to respond in light of his truth. Let's all pray together.